welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, we are interviewing Ana Flores and Kayla Tindall. Together for 17 years and married for six. They have two children together and are the founding members of North Bay LGBTQI Families Group.
Prior to moving to Santa Rosa, Ana was a behavioral consultant and worked with children in their in-home programs, facilitated social groups, and conducted parent trainings. Ana is currently a stay-at-home mom and aspires to be a teacher. She graduated with a BA in psychology from UC San Diego and finds as a parent that it is even more important in her work as an activist in the community. Hello, Ana. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Kayla is a family medicine doctor and faculty member at a local family medicine residency. Kayla graduated from UC San Diego, attended UC Davis School of Medicine, received her MPH at UC Berkeley, and completed her family medicine residency in Santa Rosa. Hello, Kayla, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
We have a lot more to learn about how Ana and Kayla navigate their lives. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moraglia.
This is Greg Moraglia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of August 2nd, 2020. After months of working on the front lines treating patients with COVID-19, Dr. Joseph Costa, the chief of critical care at Baltimore's Mercy Medical Center, and also a gay man, died of the virus last Saturday as his husband held him. About 20 colleagues of the hospital were at his side holding a vigil before his death. Mercy Medical Center released a statement regarding his commitment to helping others. Having graduated from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in 1990, Costa began working at Mercy Medical in 1997. He specialized in pulmonary and critical care and was the chief of the critical care unit for 15 years. His husband said, quote, "I get so angry when I see people not wearing masks. It makes me want to take a bar of soap and write on my car's rearview window, quote, 'My husband, who saved so many lives, died of COVID-19. Wear a mask,'" end quote. In Shaler Township, Pennsylvania, residents gathered to oppose the systematic violence aimed at black people by authorities, spurring a motley group of Trump supporters to gather to, quote, "support the police." And it wasn't long before one of the protesters started yelling, quote, "kill transgenders." According to a local CBS News affiliate, the unidentified man was caught on videotape shouting the phrase repeatedly outside the Shaler Middle School, where about 100 people had gathered in support of Black Lives Matter. While some of the cohorts joined in the chant, most people, on both sides, looked on with shock. The protests remained nonviolent, with only an exchange of words. And if you've ever taken an Alaskan cruise, you've no doubt stopped in Ketchikan. This small town has the world's largest collection of standing Native American totem poles and numerous bald eagles. In addition to a thriving tourism industry, this small town just passed an ordinance prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people, and it was passed unanimously by the city council after an incident earlier this month involving a local florist, Heather Dalen. She's the owner of Heavenly Creations, who made news for allegedly refusing to take an order from a same-sex couple. She told a local news outlet, quote, "When it comes to the holy sacrament of marriage, God's word is clear." But the city council didn't buy it, and the new ordinance prohibiting discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations goes into effect next month. And finally, racial and anti-LGBTQ bias persists in ride-sharing services, even though companies have taken steps to reduce it. A new study from the Indiana University's Bloomington's Kelley School of Business shows that an indication of support for LGBTQ plus equality can trigger a bias. Platforms such as Uber, Lyft, and Via responded to drivers' biased behavior by removing information that would indicate a rider's gender and race from initial ride requests. According to a press release from the university, researchers still found that bias against underrepresented groups and those who indicate support of the LGBT community continued to exist after drivers accepted a ride request. The authors of the study suggested that ride-sharing companies could penalize drivers who exhibit biased behaviors. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. But I don't know what
to do. And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. We are talking with Ana Flores and Kayla Tyndall, together for 17 years, married for 6, and parents of 2 kids. Welcome, both of you. We're so happy to have you on.
We're excited to be here.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was talking to Cher, and we were trying to decide. I was trying to decide, when was the first time I met you, Ana? I don't know. It was at the Women's March in Petaluma. I don't know. Was it just on Facebook? But we became friends, and I was just trying to figure it all out. Because I've been seeing you a lot for Black Lives Matter, you know, those different events, and trying to figure it out. And I was going to say, well, I'm going to ask Ana and see what she says.
I had seen you at different events. Our circles cross often at different in different mediums. But I think the first time that I actually got introduced with you, I would say, was probably the Petaluma Women's March.
That was January 1919, so a good while ago. And so lately, during the Black Lives Matter, I've just been seeing a lot of you. And it's always a pleasure to see you. And you're so welcoming and so embracing. And so, you know, I think you're cool. I like you. So I was saying, Cher, we should invite Ana. And then I met Kayla a few times. And it's like, okay, perfect couple. You're so diverse. You have so much going on. So I'm just really happy to have you both here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, likewise. I've been following some of the work that you do with your plays and with when you speak at events and stuff. So I'm glad that we finally connected and that we can continue to grow together, because I'm glad to have you in my life.
Thank you. I feel the same way too. So is there something else we missed? I mean, that was a whole list of talents and careers that you both are involved in. Did we miss anything to start with before we delve in? Is there anything, other things you want to introduce yourself with?
The only thing I thought of through the intro is that we changed our name when we got married to where we both have Flores Tyndall. So I'm Kayla Flores Tyndall and she's Ana Flores Tyndall, and our kids have that too. And it's interesting because it's a topic that comes up a lot, because the world is just not set up for 2 last names. So people will hyphenate or they'll just drop one or the other. And we run into trouble with it all the time. Whenever someone can't find us, I'm like, try the other name. And I always say, isn't like most of Latin America people have 2 last names, but we have not managed as a system to figure it out. So I like to stand in solidarity with the 2 last names. And I'm constantly being asked to shorten it. Can't you just pick one? Like, let's just use the Tyndall. I'm like, no, I like both. So yeah, I just thought I'd bring that up as a discussion point.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope we didn't miss it. we didn't do anything, but thank you for bringing it up. But that's interesting that people want you to drop one of the names. That's just odd to hear that. Good for you to just be strong and insist on, hey, we want both. Just talk briefly about your activism, because Black Lives Matters are so big and huge right now. And then we move into your relationship and your kids and your family. My guess is that you're more active in a lot of different areas in your life, not just because of Black Lives Matter. So if you want to start there and give us a little bit of your activism history, that would be powerful.
We grew up in a pretty small town, so there wasn't a lot of opportunities for us to be with the community that was passionate about change and changing the systematic racism. In fact, we were often, I felt, pushed against doing that. Since we went to college, I have had even some teachers actually from my high school contact me and apologize for certain things that they said. More recently, a month ago, a teacher from high school messaged me apologizing. You know, in high school, you and Kayla organized this walkout on May Day from school, and I was encouraging you against it. And I was just saying, like, keep quiet, be peaceful, like, things will happen. And she wanted to apologize for that and her ignorance at that time, what she called it. And so I definitely felt like in high school, we didn't have that platform, even though we did try. You know, we were the first gay couple to go to prom together, not straight couple, because you weren't allowed to go to prom as a same sex couple unless you were actually out like together, which was messed up. It was supposedly so that they could still get enough funding, and if you bought it as a couple, that's like $5 off or something. So that's how it started. And in college, I think that's when our work kind of like just going, there was more opportunities to show up and be present. And something that became very crucial to us was to do it through a lens of intersectionality. It becomes very burdensome as a person who is wants to do change or be active in the community to be discriminated against while being supportive to another community. What I mean by that is if we would go for something like, let's say, migrant rights related, DACA related, anything that had to do with something else as an ally, we felt sometimes unwelcome because of being LGBT. So we started connecting with people that would organize these events where they would be, you know, the crowd would be fired up and they would say, and it's not just enough to show up for migrant rights. You got to show up for LGBT people. You got to show up for women. And that's where our passion kind of grew about intersectional work, which is the same platform that we try to keep with the North Bay LGBTQI Families Group, is that we want to create a space in which we are advocating for our families. And that means that we have to take an intersectional approach.
Yeah, some things I thought of while you were talking is in high school, I was in the like student body leadership and I was in charge of the monthly board. And so one of the things I did a board on was, I think it was Pride Month, and putting some statistics and information about the LGBT community. And I remember getting so much harassment for that, like people writing on it, people saying a lot of negative things. And instead of the office supporting us, we were asked to take it down and we were told that we couldn't have that up. And then I was bullied pretty badly in senior year. And it was specifically because we were together. She outed me. She told me she was going to beat me up so bad I couldn't walk for a month, kill all the gays in the school. It was pretty bad in that language and the just the hate and directed at us because we were LGBT, and much more at me than towards Anna. And there was this movement from people in our class that really rallied around us and in support. And there was a really beautiful like rallying of support as people were allies and stood up for us and said stuff to her and really said, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to be bystanders. I was more of the receiver. I wasn't that active in that, but it was nice to see the power of that. And then in college, I think the Women's Center made a really big difference. Us having a Women's Center and learning about feminism in a way we had never even heard that word or that language, and having that exposure. There was also an LGBT center that we spent some time in that was helpful, and we joined a migrant rights awareness group that was our first kind of official activism and joining protests and really getting involved. One of our good friends that actually was the founder of that group, he was the person that married us at our wedding. He's still a really good friend and really involved in our kids' lives, and we know him since he founded Migrant Rights Awareness at UC San Diego. So it has been a key kind of core component throughout.
Thank you for your courage. I mean, high school, to be able to step up and be a voice. Yeah, I'm sorry about the bullying, Kayla. I mean, it's awful. Yeah, but it's wonderful that you had the support of students to come forth and say, hey, this is not cool. This is not okay.
Yeah, the students were much better than the administration, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah, one of the things that was very hard for us is that, you know, teachers and like the principal, you know, weren't doing much about it. I just didn't understand how much more evidence they needed. And one of the reasons why the person that was bullying Kayla would not really say anything to me. We played sports together, and also she was judgmental towards my body frame. She's like, oh, I can't take Anna, but I can take Kayla per se. And so I actually, when the principal didn't do anything, we did end up going to the police because we had text messages, we had phone calls, and we basically, you know, when we did our senior trip, they keyed a bunch of the cars of people that were standing up for us, threw a rock through somebody's windshield, like that kind of stuff. And we had evidence of that happening. So eventually there was some like two hate crimes against some people. And I'm glad that the community itself did come together. And luckily we did have the outlet. You know, people were showing up to our houses and saying like, hey, I just found out. I'm just wanted to let you know I'm here. And that definitely made a huge impact.
Where were you from again?
So I was born in Mexico. I moved to the United States when I was 8 years old. That's actually when I met my partner.
When you were eight?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were in the same third grade class.
We did try to hang out, but she didn't know any Spanish. I didn't know any English. But we still tried to like make it work. We have some memories of that happening. Like I taught her some words in Spanish and things like that. And then to me, it also became very apparent that there was a lot of segregation in our school. Like you Latinos stuck with Latinos. And if you were white, you stuck with the whites. And within that, there was cliques, right? So, and then after that year.
That's when tracking started. Our school started in fourth grade. They started tracking and it ended up being segregation. So I went from having integrated classrooms with about half Latinos in my class from kindergarten through third grade. And then from fourth grade on, they just disappeared from my classes because of tracking. And so all of the Latinos were put in the same track, the same class. And I was in another track with all white kids and they just disappeared from my social consciousness. I remember having a big birthday party where I felt like I invited everyone in the school. And it wasn't till the next year when I became friends with Anna that I realized it was every white kid in the school. It was, there were no Latinos at all. And the reason I even opened my eyes to her world was because one of my friends decided to join the basketball team. And we had always played soccer. And she was like, you want to join with me? And I'm like, sure, I don't know, why not? So we all did it together. And so that was where we, in eighth grade, where we reconnected and became good friends. And
well, I fell in love with her then, but it took two more years for us to to come together. Yeah, and then it wasn't until like a year and a half or so later that we started like coming out to more people. Yeah, so we grew up in Mammoth. After we finished high school, we went down to San Diego for undergrad. And then we moved to Sacramento when she was doing medical school and I was working there. And then we moved here and we've been here since. And we plan on staying.
What a love story between you two. You met your love in third grade. And then eighth grade, you see her again on the basketball team. Was she any good?
She was good. I was a soccer player, so I wasn't so good. I got to play on the court with her once or twice. Mostly I sat on the bench.
Yeah, I think I thought that you usually went in for me. So like I don't think we were together on the court very often.
Yeah, we were all friends and all my friends loved her and everyone like wanted to hug her all the time. But I definitely noticed feeling a little bit of jealousy of like, no, I have to be closer to her than all of you. Like you can be friends too, but I need to be extra special. Like I can't let you get closer than me, because that was before. I was not aware of my sexual orientation at all at that point. Still had lots of boy crushes and complete oblivion to why I would break up with them before they'd kiss me, because they'd try to kiss me and stay with me for about 3 months until I couldn't avoid it any longer and would break up with them. But I didn't really know what that meant, because it still felt like crushes. I still feel like, you know, it was. I still had romantic attraction. I just didn't want to do anything else.
Anna said she fell in love with you when she met you back in eighth grade. But tell us when you fell in love with Anna.
I mean, I feel like it's the same for me. It just was a little bit more of this nebulous, ambiguous, like from friends morphing into more than friends is a little bit nebulous. There was no like moment of where, you know, she's still my best friend and good friend. And it wasn't like some drastic shift from realizing like this is love like a friend and this is in love like a partner. But it just, everything progressed slowly and we were always checking in with each other and just kind of listening to my body and everything felt right. So I just went with it. We'd be like, what does this mean? I don't know, but I like it. So let's just not label it and let it keep going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would definitely agree that it was just a very organic development. And I think that was the biggest thing, is that like neither of us were open about our orientation or had really like questioned it. And it's one of those things that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people in the LGBT community can relate to, is that when you accept yourself and come out to yourself, then you can then look back in your life and see, oh, that's what that meant, you know? So it's like one of those things where obviously we knew we weren't straight a lot younger, but we didn't know that that's what it was.
Yeah, I didn't have any reference frames or anything. Like, I remember seeing an Ellen DeGeneres article in a magazine and like getting that magazine and reading it, and that being the first time of seeing anything in media. I had never seen anything in a show or heard it really talked about. It just didn't, it wasn't a vocabulary, or I didn't know anyone from the LGBT community. It wasn't, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So you weren't even, you didn't even know. You have role models in your school, no teachers, no friends or family. Everything was hush hush and people were in the closet deeply. Right. So here you are trying to, two young people trying to figure it all out.
Yep.
So then when you figured it all out, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, you decided to go to the prom. So how was that decision and letting everybody, that's a big statement to go to the prom together. I mean, right. So you were there.
Yeah. By then, a lot of the bullying and the like whole threatening to kill all the gays in school and stuff had taken place. And it was towards the end of the year, right? Because we're talking about prom, almost graduation and stuff. And so we had a really good support by then. Like, basically, I felt like the majority of our classmates had rallied in some form or another. Our 12th grade, you know, we had a 75 graduating class. So it wasn't that big. And so everybody knew your business. It wasn't necessarily like the talk of the town that I know about, which it was probably a good thing, but it was definitely, it was an easier transition to be able to do that because of the support. You know, most of the time, you know, prom is 11th and 12th grade. And when you have the classmates stepping up for you, it just makes it a lot easier. By then I had run away from home because I had told my mom, who was struggling with it. And I knew the day was getting closer into where I had to tell my dad, and I had it, you know, this image in my head that when my dad found out, I did not want to be at home. And I don't know what it would have been like if I had stayed, but I decided to run away and wrote him a letter explaining why. And so by then I wasn't living at home anymore. And so it also was liberating in that way, that I didn't feel like I had to explain that to my parents or stand up. Like, there was a pain that has got us to where we are now. And I have a beautiful relationship with my parents now. And they are very loving and supportive of our family. But back then, not being at home, staying with a friend who was one of our main allies throughout this whole thing, and being able to go to prom together. And it wasn't just that our classmates were sticking up for us. I mean, we're talking about the, you know, quote unquote popular kids, right? Like the ones that are football players, like starters, right? Like cheerleaders, like everyone wants to date them kind of thing. So that, I think that's what made a huge impact. It was like, it wasn't just people standing up to us. It was people that were respected in the community.
Two of the male, more tough, popular kids showed up at my house one day. They just like showed up. And they're like, we're just here because we wanted to tell you that we support you and we're going to stand up for you. One of them was holding a hockey stick. I'm not sure what that meant. It was like, I'm going to use this hockey stick if I need to. But we just want you to feel supported and like we have your back. And so, yeah, there was some really beautiful little stories of ally behavior.
True allies. I felt that. I was really touching to hear that story, right? So, yeah, we want to know about your coming out and your relationship with your parents, for sure. And that was a journey in itself, Anna, you and your parents, and feeling the need to run away. You know, I would like to hear more about that. And then I would like to hear, Kayla, about your parents and your situation.
Yeah. You know, coming out for me was interesting because there was such a mix of responses. You know, I grew up in a Catholic household, and within my family, I grew up hearing a lot of like support for the gay community in the sense of like, oh, that actor's gay or that singer's gay. You know, like we grew up hearing, you know, Ricky Martin and Walter Mercado, the psychic person who's like very popular in Latin America and stuff. And, you know, Juan Gabriel, like all these artists that were like very well known and gay. So I heard my parents like mentioning gay people around me, but it was never like bad, right? Like it wasn't really bad. They knew we had gay friends and they would come over. So I thought I would have a good support system. And I don't know why, maybe it was because of my exposure within the Catholic Church and what I grew up hearing, that I knew I wouldn't have that support. So that was a very hard thing for me. And in addition to that, I also have 7 siblings. So it was one of those things that once you come out to one, you got to come out to like all of them, right? And that was my youngest brother I'm pretty close to. And he actually, I think he like saw us kissing or something, and that's how he figured it out. And I was not ready to come out yet. But then once my brother knew, I knew the ball was going to get rolling, you know, like that I was going to need to start telling people. And you know, I had mixed reactions. Like I told my second to youngest sister, I remember I was crying and I told her, and I actually had woken her up and she was just sitting in the bed listening to me. And the first thing that came out of her mouth is, "And what can I do to help?" She was like 10 or something, you know. Like 11, she's really young. And she just like, I broke down because it's like, what else could you say that is like, that's like the perfect thing to say, you know? And I just like, I was like, I don't know how to tell my parents and stuff. So, you know, my youngest sister, like my second youngest, like she's my rock. I mean, like I told her, I want to be like her when I grow up. She's killing it, man. She's making all kinds of great things in the community. And I really love her for everything that she is and what she does. And so it's hard for me to have a explanation of what my experience coming out was, because there were so many people that I had to come out with. And it's like, not everybody was good. You know, like one of my brothers that I'm not that close to, I didn't tell him. He just figured it out because I was coming out to other siblings. And then he would say a lot of homophobic things and make fun of me for wearing clothes that was supposed to be for males, or wearing cologne instead of perfume and things like that. And he would just like say homophobic things around me. That was no different than what it was growing up, because I was a tomboy and he would chase me around the house calling me boy until I cried, right? So it's like some of those things didn't change. They were just enhanced. But overall, I think that Kayla and I chose very carefully who to tell in the beginning. And I think that made a huge difference, because regardless of what somebody's reaction was, if it was a negative one, we had people to fall to, you know? And I think that having that foundation of support and ally was like huge for my coming out, at least.
So you both brought a song tonight that's very important to you. We'd like you to introduce it.
So we chose a song that's called Mujer Contra Mujer from a band called Mecano from Spain. The song has also been translated to French and Italian. It was written in 86, but it wasn't until 88 that it came out. And it was one of the first like Spanish, or in particularly for Spain, LGBT related song. And it talks about two women who are openly out, open love, you know, same sex love. And it's a song that we chose for our wedding. And it's, you know, two women trying to navigate the world with, you know, having to cover up their love with just friendship when behind closed doors, there's a lot more. And it's a very special song to us.
That's beautiful. All right, everyone, enjoy Mujer Contra Mujer. And we'll be back.
Nada tienen de especial dos mujeres que se dan la mano. El matiz viene después, cuando lo hacen por debajo del mantel, luego a solas, sin nada que perder. Tras las manos va el resto de la piel. Un amor por ocultar, aunque en cueros no hay donde esconderlo, lo disfrazan de amistad. pasear por la ciudad. Una opina que aquello no está bien. La otra opina que qué se le va a hacer. Y lo que opinen los demás está de más. ¿Quién detiene palomas al vuelo, volando a ras de suelo, mujer contra mujer? No estoy yo por la labor de tirarles la primera piedra. Si equivoco la ocasión y las año labio a labio en el salón, ni siquiera me atrevería a toser. Si no gusto, ya sé lo que hay que hacer. Que con mis piedras hacen ellas su pared. ¿Quién detiene palomas al vuelo, volando a ras de suelo, mujer contra mujer?
So welcome back. If you just joined us, this is Living Proof, and we are talking with Ana and Kayla Flores Tyndall, and they are sharing their lives with us. They met in high school in eighth grade, first in third grade, then in eighth grade, and then they're telling us about how they fell in love and how they came out to their families. And so, Kayla, you were going to share about how you came out to your family.
Yeah, so I think I was 15. It was about then. And I remember just sitting there sobbing and crying because I knew I was going to tell my mom. She was worried it was something really bad because I was just crying and she had to like ask me questions to get it out of me. So I think it was a huge relief that that was it, that it wasn't something more serious since I was crying. And my mom has been an incredible like support person for us. She's still one of my really good friends and she's so thrilled that we have the little kids. She's their Nana and she's just been wonderful. And I came out to each of them separately. I told my dad separately. I told him that I was in love with Anna and he said that I was too young to be in love and too young to know what love was, which is something I've heard in a podcast before where some of the speakers were like making fun of young people love, like they don't know what they're talking about. And so it's one of those little things that bugs me because I'm like, sometimes they do. And it happens that my grandparents were high school sweethearts and they, you know, were together over 50 years until one of them died on both sides. Actually, my mom's parents and my dad's parents were high school sweethearts and married till the end. And so I'm like, it is possible to know and be in love really early. And we just let, you know, it was a process for him to kind of come to acceptance. And I think we're definitely at acceptance. It hasn't always been easy. We're happy with it.
So when you were being bullied in high school, was your family there for you, or were you able to tell them about it?
I didn't really tell them much. I mostly kept it away. I mean, my mom knew she wasn't nice. Like, my mom knew she wasn't, she knew of her and that she wasn't being very nice to me, but I definitely didn't tell her the extent to what was going on.
I mean, her brother was in high school with us, so he might have heard stuff about it, but
I don't remember if there was, like, if there was a point where she knew more of the details. I don't really remember the details of that. I remember a key thing at that time was, like, we had asked them to not let her be at our graduation because I was the valedictorian and had to give a valedictorian speech. And I was like, I don't think it's fair that she should be allowed to be at my graduation because she's not even graduating. She was the year below us. They were considering expulsion, and yet they wouldn't uphold our request to not let her attend the graduation. And I was like, that just doesn't seem, I mean, we lost that fight. She ended up being allowed to attend graduation. So I'm not sure, like, at that point when things had settled down and I was fighting for her not to be at graduation, my mom might have known that we were fighting for that, but I don't remember anything beyond that.
I'm curious, has she come around yet to apologize for her behavior?
No. It's really funny, actually, because we did run into her, what do you think, that was like a year ago?
Couple years ago, probably.
She was walking her dog and we were visiting our family in Mammoth, and I was walking in front of Kayla with my family, and as soon as I saw her, you know, because it's triggering for Kayla. For me, I was just mad, right? Like, I just like, oh, like, I don't want to see you. But as soon as I saw her, I was like, I gotta go check in on Kayla, because I had no idea how Kayla was gonna react to seeing her bully, you know. So I said, hey, Kayla, can you, like, come over here or something? I said something to her in Spanish, like, to get off the path or that we were walking on and stuff. And she was just very confused about what I was doing. And then she noticed why. And then she, like, kind of came to me. And she was alone. I have no idea what she's up to in her life. I didn't feel like there was a need to start anything or initiate anything. Honestly, I wish her the best. I hope that she has found some healing and some, you know, for the hatred that she carried on. And quite honestly, I think part of it was self-homophobia, because there was a lot of rumors about what her and her best friend, and that they might have had a thing together. And if that's true, I really hope that she found some healing and figured that out for herself.
And if anything, when we saw her, I mean, there was definitely, to read body language, I mean, yes, we were not alone and there was a bunch of us, but if anything, it seemed like if you had to put a feeling on her, that it was shame. I mean, she didn't say anything. She avoided eye contact.
Yeah, before she would often walk with, like, pride and, like, she owned the ground she was walking on. And definitely that time she seemed more like she was stepping on somebody else's territory, I would say. Mama. Apparently my son poo-pooed, so. Two poo-poos. You want to tell them?
Hi.
Say hi.
Hi.
So then on the walk, when Anna pulled you aside, then your the bully, the young woman who was the bully, she saw you, you saw her, and then she just put her eyes down and kept walking. Ah.
Yeah, it wasn't just the two of us. We were with Anna's family. We were with sisters and nieces. There was a whole bunch of us, and she was alone.
I can feel you, Kayla, telling your story, coming out, and Anna telling her story, coming out. I can feel that thread of sadness, you know, the lack of support of what you had to go through. And your story is like many stories, right, because of that. Being LGBTQ or whatever, we don't have that freedom to just be ours. I mean, shame, and we hear those stories so often, and it's so sad. And I appreciate your strength, Anna, to bless her. You know, you both are sending her off with well wishes. It's unfortunate somebody can't help her, you know, and people like that. And we hear stories of bullies, and most of them are homophobic because of their own internalized homophobic, you know, whatever that phobia is, transphobia, whatever it is that they're demon, they're dealing with that. And that's just really sad. So I appreciate your honesty and you telling us that and sharing your story with us.
Yeah, I think it has also given me a story of adversity, and I feel really lucky to have gotten through it without being physically harmed and with a lot of support, like I mentioned, that rallied around me. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where when I walk the world with so much privilege, being a white person, being cisgendered and passing, like nobody knows I'm gay unless I tell them. So having that story, I think, has been really important and helpful for me in understanding being othered and understanding people who have stories of oppression. I think it was a really nice, just enough to figure it out and have like this strong sense of solidarity and not too much that it really got me down. So I feel really blessed that that is my story of adversity and that I, you know, it was okay overall.
Yeah, I would definitely add to that and say that it also taught us allyship. We know how beautiful it was for us to have people show up. I mean, because like some people were like, well, what do you care? You're not gay, right? To our allies. And it's like, well, why do you care if they are, kind of thing, right? And sometimes, and it comes in different ways, you know. One of the guys was just following her saying, gay's okay, you know. She had a straight pride sticker on her truck. So one of our friends, the one that I was living with, where I ran away, took white out and put a dress on the other.
It was like the bathroom signs. And so she added a dress. It was like two female symbols and on her truck, and it was there for a while.
She figured it out. Yeah. So you know, allyship looks differently. Sometimes it's them coming up to you and just letting the person know you're there for them, right? And I think definitely helped me find my voice too, because people were asking us questions like, how are you feeling? How can we support you? Yeah, in addition to having that experience and exposure to being othered, I think they also brought shine light on the fact that that's why we should show up for people. Because people say the same thing about me, right? You're not Black. Why are you showing up to the Black Lives Matter? And I think that's something that I always carry with me. It's like, I don't need to be the one Black to marginalize or other for solidarity at all. So
I think that's the way we need more allyship. We need more people taking part in that. And I've heard lots of stories, and a lot of people are struggling to do that because they don't want to be outed in such a way like, you're not Black, so why are you doing this? And why does it matter? And it needs to matter. So I appreciate you both, really. So we're going to shift gears a little bit because we want to hear about the family part of you two. Because we've been having a few interruptions with the kids, and that makes sense. So we want to know about your family life and how did that all come out? Who decided to have babies? And Anna, you work with children. That's part of your DNA. You seem like you like doing that work. And so we'd like to know more about that. And so who wants to start?
Yeah, I mean, for me, having children was always something I envisioned in whatever form that was. We started going to an orphanage when we were in high school. And then we continued to do that when we were in college. And there was this kid there that I just became very connected with. And I wanted to adopt, but they don't separate siblings. And there was three of them. And as a single college student, there wasn't much I could do, especially with that the kid was in Mexico and bringing her here. And back then I was not a citizen. And so that was just gonna be hard. But my point is that was like something that I have always wanted, children in my life and whatever form that may be. So when I imagine my future, I always imagine raising kids. I never really imagine being pregnant though, or like carrying them. That wasn't as important to me as like just having them, you know?
So when I was in medical school, I mean, I've always wanted kids and wanted to be pregnant. In medical school, I remember specifically hearing this professor say that medicine was the profession with the greatest delayed gratification, and that everybody just puts aside their lives to get through this really long journey. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. Like, I am not okay with letting my career get in the way of my family planning. And if my family gets in the way of my career, I can live with that. But if my career gets in the way of my family, I can't live with that. So I'm just going to do it. And there was also this Doc Mama group, and one of my
mentors who was really supportive. When I asked her about like having a baby in medical school, she was totally supportive. And she told me about this Doc Mama group that had found some research about having kids while you're still growing in your career, just then your kids kind of grow with you and they become more adaptable because they go with the changes. It's not like you're all settled and then you bring in kids and it's very unsettling. You just sort of, you're unsettled together as you grow and adapt. So that just sounded just right for us. We have actually talked a lot about this because I wrote a case for medical school. When I was in my fourth year, I wrote a case for the first year medical students when they're learning about reproductive endocrinology. So they use our story in learning about different, some of the genetics and some of the reproductive endocrinology topics. And every year since, we've gone back to talk to the medical students. So we have a lecture hall full of first year medical students asking us questions, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this story and answering questions. Just this year, we found out they're going to make it required, so we get to reach even more medical students, and they've continued it on for, I think, now 6 years. So that's good, just that going out there, future doctors will have that exposure.
Did you have both babies, Kayla?
Yeah, I carried them both and used Donna's eggs and donor sperm from the Sperm Bank of California, which is an incredible organization that's been serving LGBT and single women since before anyone else was, and they're a nonprofit. So we're very grateful to them and their service. And so we made embryos at one time. So technically our 5 and 2-year-old are kind of like fraternal twins, but one was frozen in time for 3 years. And then we put in a second embryo actually using natural cycle frozen embryo transfer, which was made the process so much better than the first time. I didn't need all the shots. It just was way less medicalized, way easier. And we've also talked to a lot of other couples in their parenting journey, and it can be really, really tough and really hard. And we were really lucky in both times, got pregnant with one embryo the first time. So we had incredible luck on our side that made it all work out. And so, yeah, that's how we did it.
So Anna, so you're the at-home mom. Tell us about that experience.
I started working when I was 11 years old and giving my parents money every month, essentially paying rent. Since I was 11 until I went to college, I worked summers, holidays, everything. It's a tourist town, so you work when you can. And so I worked all through you know, when college and when I graduated and I was working, and we were going to be moving here. And my job in Sacramento was to work with children, right? And I was doing a lot of early intervention learning. And it's basically something you do with any child, regardless of whether they have a diagnosis or not. And when I was working, I just found myself, it's a really rewarding job, but it is very draining, you know, depending on what behaviors a kid had that day. And I just felt like at the end of the day, I was so drained that like it was, I could see that it would be challenging to then find the energy to be there for my kids, especially when it was something I could be doing with them, right? The early intervention or like just learning in general. That was one of my motivators. Also, I didn't think I would be a good stay-at-home mom. I get bored very easy, and I just thought that I would be very bad at it. But joke's on me, because they keep you entertained all day long.
And you don't really, until COVID, didn't really stay at home.
Yeah, I always joke when people say you're a stay-at-home mom. I say, no, I'm an out-and-about mom.
Full-time mom.
And Kayla at that time was doing certain rotations in different areas and was splitting her maternity leave differently. So there was times where she had to work and I was off work, or then we were kind of switching it. It was a little bit complicated how we did it. But one of the times we actually ended up in Santa Rosa for a rotation and I fell in love with the area. So I got little like screenshots, you know, per se, of what it was going to be like. And I just loved it. I felt like Kia, our oldest child, her style of learning was so compatible to my style of teaching, what I was doing then. And I say that just because, I mean, she's a really smart kid and picked up things fast. And so a lot of the times parents would be like, well, my kid isn't doing that, because she was talking a full sentence like a 10 months. And so people would like, you know, and it's, I think it has a lot to do with, well, one, I was staying with her. Two, I had training, right? That's what I did for a living. Three, I think the most important is that her learning style was compatible to what I was doing with her. And we were just blessed. And our connection was just so deep. And, you know, we were going to move here. So I was like, we can, you know, move to an area where we don't know anybody, trying to find a daycare with strangers that we don't know, or we can just be tight on money and all stay at home. That way she still gets to see the kids for her lunch break when she has options and get pictures of the kids and what, or, you know, our kid back then and what they're doing. And I just feel like it has transitioned really well for us.
Yeah, residency is hard and the hours are hard, and I would work. The requirement is no more than 80 hours in a week on average over 4 weeks. So I could work 90 hours in a week if the other hours were, the other weeks were less. You know, I at one point did 13 nights in a row while pregnant. I mean, residency is really hard. And so to have her at home made such a huge, huge difference. It was, I would not have had another kid while in residency if I didn't have her full time at home and her wanting to and her full support and everything that she did. I didn't do laundry throughout that time. She cooked everything. She just has, you know, supported me so much and made it all possible for me, for sure. So
I want to know, what do you like to do together? Do you have any opportunity for that? Pavement, you know, activism, being activist. Is there something that you like to just do? Maybe you don't have time to do it now, but you just really enjoy doing things together?
Yeah, no, we just love doing everything together. I feel like the pandemic has been so hard for people, and we're really blessed that we have a home, that we have a big backyard. Our kids love to just be here, and we just love to be present with our kids, and we have a garden that we've made with them, and we've, you know, we have this little granny unit we've been tearing apart and painting and working on with them. We go to the beach, we go to the redwoods, we go just walk around the neighborhood or go on bike rides. I feel like we're very good at having intense quality time all the time that I'm away, and I don't work crazy hours anymore. I work, you know, it's reasonable, and I have weekends, and I don't work at night, and we have our family dinners. My grandmother moved in with us in January, so we have her in the house too. We have our intergenerational household, and she's, you know, we all say what we're thankful for every night and go around the table, and really, I feel like we really enjoy each other's company and have a lot of enjoyable, fun time together.
Thank you. Anna, anything you want to add before we move on to in our beautiful show?
So I guess I would just add that, you know, within what we like to do as activists and involvement and things like that, when people say that kids are too young to learn or that they don't understand and things like that, I mean, I really invite people to challenge themselves. I think sometimes it's like we are too afraid to explain it to kids, or like that we have to change the wording too much. We're very open with our children. I mean, we have never gone to a protest that we do not tell them why we're there. And we have those open communications with them. You know, I even like play with my daughter and I say, you know, well, what would you say if someone comes up to you and says, well, all lives matter, right? And she just processes these things on her own. Cause I mean, part of it is I want her to have her own opinions too, you know? And she just says, well, I would just tell them, yes, all lives matter, but they're not the ones that need our help right now. We go to these things and she just gets really passionate about it, you know, like environmental shows or protests or things like that. You know, she'll just be like, protect the trees. And she just like gets so passionate and involved in what she's doing. She's really good at using the correct pronouns. We're exposing my son to that
too. They'll be playing and they'll say, what pronouns do you use? And they'll ask the toy which pronouns they use.
Yeah, and
people are surprised they even know the word pronoun when they...
mm-hmm. So I definitely would say that like us as adults have to challenge ourselves to try to reach to the younger generations. I mean, like, they're eager, you know, they get it. I think it's just we have those excuses with adults too, right? Like, oh, they're old-fashioned.
So we do have to close our show now, and before we end, we always like to ask our guests if they have words of wisdom to the listeners out there.
I think, you know, when we decided to embark on the journey of getting pregnant, we proactively started counseling, and we had the privilege of having, access to counseling free of charge. And I know that can be a big barrier, but our couples counselor was just so refreshed because she's like, usually people come to couples counseling when it's way too late. And I think being proactive and learning those communication skills before we really needed it was so, so incredibly helpful. And we go back there whenever we are having a harder time. And I just think that those key communication skills to slow down and to, you know, say things from your perspective and all the things that we learned to really work through whatever comes up has just been absolutely like key in us having as close of a relationship as we have right now and making it through, you know, through all of what we've made it through. So
thank you, Tim. And Anna, I know you're a woman with a lot of knowledge. Is there any inspiration you can give people based on what you've gone through? Audience need to hear what you all are sharing. Thank you so much for that, Kate.
Yeah, I mean, as far as our relationship, when people ask what it takes, everyone's different, obviously. But for us, I think that one thing that has been really important is that we have never stopped acknowledging that we are choosing one another. Right? Like, we got married on paper, but before that we had made a commitment to one another. But paper doesn't mean anything. It's what you give it, right? So like, if, you know, I'll just randomly remind, like, tell her, you know, thank you for choosing me today. Because every waking day, you know, she is choosing me as her partner, and I'm choosing her. And so I think just vocalizing that to each other, I think that like just little appreciations of that goes a long way. And something that like keeps you grounded, right? And like Kayla mentioned, we do that with our children every day during dinner. We all go around saying what we're thankful for. And I think just kind of to have you, you know, it helps us reflect on our day and to remind ourselves that there's something to be thankful for in the midst of everything. I just think that like any day she can decide not to be with me, right? And so like that, I think that's the most thing that has been like really beautiful about our relationship is that we acknowledge that about each other and that we thank each other for that.
Beautiful. I want to thank you both for your time and commitment to be here with us. And it's been a beautiful, I feel really moved in my heart. And thank you for your honesty and showing up.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us. Yeah.
This is my first time on the radio, by the way.
What? I told you you're natural. Congratulations to you. Both of you. Thank you.
We want everyone to remember, like Kayla and Anna, you too can be living proof that through sharing your passion, your life, and your creative expression, you can make our world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then.
Good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can.
Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Cheryl Kabanuck. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on Radio 91. And if you didn't get a chance to participate in our summer fundraiser, you can do so now by going online to norcalpublicmedia.org/donate. Every dollar you contribute helps keeping Outbeat Radio coming to you every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
What have you done today to make you feel proud?
yeah. So do it today, yeah. Cause I can see you.
On air, online, or on the go, we are Radio 91 KRCB FM Windsor and K215 CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next.